everyone everywhere, and special greetings to all those seated in heavenly places in Jesus, our Messiah. The name of this broadcast is Cross the Border, and I'm Nicholas, and this is a Prophecy Reality News Edition. And, well, that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about some news items. I want to talk a little bit more about America's place in prophecy. And whatever else comes up in the chat room or during the hour. And in the second hour, we're going to jump back into history and take another look or continue look at the life and times of John Huss. So you'll want to stick around for that if you're into history at all. History is very important. If most people knew history, well, it would change their view of the way things are today. Because if you can see the way things were in history, it gives you a better clue as to what's really going on. Because history, well, some people say it repeats itself, but rarely does it do that. But and others say that it rhymes, and, you know, I believe that. So if you don't know history, another one says that you're bound to repeat it. And we want to repeat the good history if we can, if there's any good history out there. Let's see. The deal of the century. Someone already brought that up in the chat room. The peace deal of the century. Well, I think you need to change the word peace from peace, as in, you know, the opposite of war, to peace, like pieces on a board or on a map, okay? And then I would agree that it is the peace deal of the century. And that sounds just like Donald Trump rhetoric, the peace deal of the century. But, you know, what do you expect? I mean, this is reality. We're dealing with the kingdoms of the world, the kingdoms ruled by Satan. And you can't expect anything else. There's not going to be any peace deal. Whoever represents the Palestinians, which weren't even there when they shook hands on the peace deal of the century. Are they going to go for it? Are they going to get part of Jerusalem? I hear that the East Jerusalem that they're going to get is not part of the Jerusalem that we know, but it's going to be a new East Jerusalem. And, you know, they should take it. They should take what they can get, because basically the peace deal of the century says that you take what we're offering you or the status quo remains. And you are losing under the status quo. And you will keep losing until you have nothing left to lose at all. And so that's pretty much the way it works. That's the way of the world. That's the kingdoms of this world, which under the rulership of Satan and his Antichrist. If you want to know why something's happening, you just have to say, well, what is the Antichrist getting out of it? You know, what does the Antichrist want? And that's what the Antichrist is going for. Now, I'm not saying the Antichrist is omnipotent and it has power. The Antichrist can be confounded. And I think that that's our job as Christians, especially as Protestant, Reformed Protestants, is to confound the Antichrist and his minions in their efforts in this world. And there's enough to confound them even without our help. It's like the whole monetary system. You know, the Antichrist has taken the whole world on this new course of fiat currency. And it's always what the Antichrist always wanted, to be able to control the currency of the world. But control is another thing. Because as you can see, you know, a lot of people are deriding Donald Trump because he has the biggest deficits ever, and they're getting bigger every year. And I think I just heard on Financial Survival they project by 2050, by 2050, that they project that the deficits will be 174% of the national product. Okay, that what the nation produces in wealth will be the borrowing of the country each year will be 174% of that. Well, that's unsustainable with real money. But with fiat currency, Well, nothing. I mean, it's unsustainable, but let's see how far we can take it. Let's see if we can get it up to 300%. You know, not one, my intuition tells me that what is unsustainable is 174% by 50-50. It's going to be more like, you know, 1,000%. But by then you have hyperinflation. So it's not sustainable. It'll never get to 174% because, well, that's the way it's going now. We're at, like, at the beginning, somewhere in the middle of the beginning, or the we're one-third the way to hyperinflation. And there's no stopping this train. That's where we're at with the monetary system. And there's really nothing we can do about it. The only thing that can really truly be done is to peg money to something that's solid, that doesn't change. You know, kind of like it used to be. Or like actually the laws that still exist. The coinage acts and so forth from, 1796 or whatever year it was that they came out with the Coinage Act, pinning the dollar to gold and silver, to so many grains of gold or silver for a dollar, because a dollar is a unit of measurement. You know, it's not a measurement of nothing. But these dollars they have now, Federal Reserve note dollars, are different kinds of dollars. They aren't pegged to anything certain because they aren't real money. So, real money. So we can see where that's going. But here's the good news. In America, a lot of people worried about it. You know, I have goats here. And I just had a goat born this year. Like, it's maybe 6 months old, if that. But it has one black horn and one white horn. It's a full-bred Nigerian buck. One black horn, one white horn. Very peculiar looking. Even funny looking to some people. But really cute if you're into goats at all. But it has one black horn and one white horn. It made me think of the final beast of the Book of Revelation, the seventh beast. And the two-horned earth beast from chapter 13 is the final beast that appears in the Bible. Now, no, I don't have any sheep. I have the goats for milk, and I sell the kids. That's all. That's what we do, but no sheep. Sorry. I have enough to do that I can't be shearing sheep, and, you know, knitting wool or whatever you do with sheep. Okay, or I guess you could eat them too. But like I said, I have too much other stuff to do. Now I'm off on a different topic altogether. But let's get back to the final beast of Revelation chapter, of the Revelation. The final beast of the scripture is the two-horned earth beast. And all of the other beast powers, well, how many other beast powers are named in the Revelation except the one? And that is the sea beast, the ten-horned sea beast. But it is also named in Old Testament prophecy, specifically Daniel. And then you have other beasts that are named in Daniel. And people have different ideas about what beasts are. Like, some people think that the Antichrist is the beast. When the Bible speaks of the beast, it is speaking of the Antichrist. But it's not. You know, that's kind of an elementary view, because the Antichrist controls the beast for a while. It's the little horn with the mouth, and it controlled the beast. It plucked up three other horns or divisions of that beast power before it. So a lot of people, like I said, that's an elementary view. It's like saying that Donald Trump is the United States of America. That's what saying that the beast is the Antichrist, and the Antichrist is the beast. It's kind of elementary. It's not true, even though Donald Trump represents America, but he is not America. Okay, it's kind of the same thing. The little horn represents or speaks for the beast, but it is not the beast. And it hasn't always spoke for the beast, and it will not always speak for the beast. But beast powers are, there's kind of rules to beast powers, and I've been studying this for a long time and trying to sort out these rules so you can figure out who these beast characters are, you know, what localities, what nations they represent. And so it's kind of important to understand how beast powers come up. And I realized one thing about all of the beast powers of the Bible, you know, apocalyptic prophecy, both from Daniel and from the Revelation, is that they're all original powers that rise up wherever they rise up. The sea beast rose up in the Western Roman area, the Western Europe. Okay, so they all rose up in that same locality. But a beast power, when it rises up, at first, when it does rise up, it rises up as an original power in the earth. And then the beast comes after it. If it's in the same locality, it assimilates the beast powers that were before it. But another thing you'll never find in the scripture is that no beast power is a division of another power. In other words, a beast power does not divide up and become different beasts. Okay? They only assimilate. They don't come out of another beast power. So when a beast appears, it assimilates powers before it. It may assimilate. Okay, if it's in the same locality, like in the, it comes up out of the sea, that's indicating the locality. So beast powers only assimilate, but they don't divide up and become separate beast powers. And once a beast power is assimilated by another beast power, it never breaks off and becomes a separate beast power again. Okay? It remains assimilated. And then you have the final beast power that appears in apocalyptic prophecy, and that is the two-horned earth beast. So we learn from the other beast powers that when a beast appears, it's an original power in itself. It's not a division of another one. So there are several people out there that say, well, the earth beast of Revelation chapter 13 was the clergy, was a division of the Roman Empire, of a division of the Catholic Church, of the great apostasy. But see, that violates the rule, doesn't it? That the beast power, when it develops as an original power in the earth. It's not a division of a power that already appeared. Okay? So we have to, if we're going to say, well, who is this two-horned earth beast power? Well, we realize it rises up in a different locality, whereas the four that came before it, including the sea beast contemporary with it in Revelation chapter 13, rose up out of the sea. This one rises up out of the earth. The locality is different, and that's why I believe it's America. Now, there's a lot of people who've written books, and it's become very popular to say that America is Mystery Babylon. No, America is not Mystery Babylon. America is the two-horned earth beast of Revelation 13, because it is the only power that rose up in a separate locality. It did not assimilate the sea beast powers before it, because that's why it comes alongside of the sea beast in Revelation chapter 13, and it helps it. See? So it can't assimilate it if it's going to exist alongside it and help it. Now, here's the good news. I was talking about my little goat with the one black horn and one white horn because I didn't have them debudded or, you know, to have the horns removed when they're young. So it has one horn that is lamb-like, and I believe this is what the determination of the description is, that one of the horns of power, it's a two-horned, because the horns represent a division of power in the beast itself. So you can have a beast that has divided powers, but the divided powers are represented by horns. And we get that from, you know, Alexander's, the Greek Empire, when Alexander rose up. And the Bible explicitly interprets this for us. Okay, when about the Greek Empire, Alexander was that singular horn. But when he died, that singular horn was broken off, and four came up in its place, and the kingdom was divided into four parts. And that's part of history. You can read about that for yourself. And the translation, the interpretation is given in the Bible itself. That's where we need to get our interpretation from. So we take that. That's what horn powers represent, a division of power within a beast. And as we have indicated by the 10 horn beasts and by the single horn beast, one horn being plucked up and four coming up in its place, that the division of power went from singular to four in the Greek Empire. And then we have the illustration of in the 10 horned sea beast that there were 10 horns. A little horn rose up, plucked up three of the horns, and then ran, you know, pretty much ran the whole kingdom for 1260 years. That was the papacy. That was the rule, the overt rule of the papacy for 1260 years. So we use that to understand what the two horns represent on this earth beast, this final beast, which must be the seventh beast that is spoken of in the Revelation, because it's the only other beast. See, because the sixth beast was contemporary with John when he wrote the Revelation, so it was the Roman Empire. And the only other one that's come up since then as a dominating power in the earth is the United States of America, because it didn't rise up in the same place as the other pieces. And some people go, well, what about Mexico and all those South American nations? And what about Canada? Don't they qualify? Well, that's the problem. See, the problem with that is that everything from Mexico through South America were vassals of the sea beast power under the little horn. So it belonged to them. They were vassal states of the papacy when it ruled for 1260 years, including Canada, which is still a vassal state of the Empire of the City of the City of London proper, which is a separate city state controlled really by the Antichrist. So everything else north of America and north of the United States of America and south of the United States of America already belong to the Antichrist and are under his control. So America stands all alone as the Protestant bastion in the world with two horns. Okay? Now the first horn is described as like a lamb. And the second horn is spake as a dragon. And, you know, today it's more evident than ever. America's so polarized between these two powers, and it is so obvious today that anybody going, yeah, this is obvious. It's always been this way, though. It's never been those two aspects of America's, those two opposing horn powers, the one white, the one black, the one lamb-like, the one that's dragon-like or dragon-speaking. And that's how America is polarized today. And you know what? That's perhaps a good thing. I mean, perhaps that's the best that it gets in the world. Yeah, thank you for that, Carrie answers. Yes, your goat is very prophetic in many ways. I was just thinking about that this morning. Really didn't even think about it till this morning when I was thinking about the two horns and how separate they are. But see, you'll notice something now. There's very little written about the earth beast of Revelation. But what's little is written about it is very important. These two horns, one isn't higher than the other. One never ever subdues the other one. But they rise, the beast rises up with the two horns, and these two horns exist through the life of the beast. They seem to be equal till through the life of the beast. So that's where we are in America. And what that means, we have to fight. You know, we have to protest in America. Because those guys, those dragon-speaking guys over there, and you hear them, they're out there every day. They pretty much control the money, the media, and everything else. It's just some things that they can't control. It's like they would like to do things where if they had one, if they were one singular horn, we'd be done with. Or if their horn rose up higher than ours, it would be over for us. It would be like the 1260-year reign of the Antichrist in Western Europe. If their horn was able to rise higher than ours. And that's what America is. It is the earth beast of the Revelation. And it exercises all the powers of the beast before it, speaking of the sea beast, in context in Revelation chapter 13. America does that. And I've made that point many times. Because America is the police power of the world. You know, Donald Trump, you know, perhaps genuinely wanted to get us out of all these countries. But he can't. He's the American, he's the mouth of the beast, of the two-horned earth beast. Donald Trump is the mouth. We voted him in. He gets to speak. He wants to do certain things, and he's found out since he's become president that he can't do those things. As a matter of fact, if he pressed too hard, he would end up like Abraham Lincoln, John Kennedy, and Ronald Reagan. All shot, right? I mean, if you push too, so you can push so hard, and when you get so much pushback, you know you have to lay off, or you're just gonna, they'll just kill you. They will just kill you. And that's because that's what the dragon does. That's what the because the dragon power in America represents the Antichrist influence that was planted in this land with the Constitutional Convention that began America under our present Constitution. And you know what the Antichrist got out of that Constitution? Oh, it got a lot of things it didn't like, but it knew what it could get with what it did like. And that was a concentration of power in Washington, D.C. Get F. Tupper Saucy's book, Rulers of Evil. Well, you can't get it. Go to my website at crosstheborder.org. There's a Bible study tab there. And on that tab, on that page there somewhere, there's a link to F. Tupper Saucy's Rulers of Evil, a PDF there. Because you won't be able to find a copy of this book. And read it. And educate yourself on the dragon power influence, how it was planted in America and became an indelible part of it. And it absolutely is represented by the two-horned earth beast of Revelation chapter 13. I'll be back in a few minutes. Don't go anywhere.
Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust, I will not be afraid. Behold, God is my strength.
Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
The book of Revelation says, "The spirit of prophecy is the testimony of Jesus Christ." This is at the very heart of FirstAmendmentRadio.com. In that spirit, we have created the Prophecy Reality News app for all of your mobile devices, streaming First Amendment Radio 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Available for your Apple, Android device, and smartphone absolutely free. Get the Prophecy Reality News app installed today. so you can listen to First Amendment Radio wherever you are. The Prophecy Reality News app. Get it now.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back. You're listening Across the Border. This is our Prophecy Reality Edition. I'm Nicholas, and today we're talking about America. Is America Mystery Babylon, or is it the two-horned earth beast of Revelation chapter 13? Well, I'm going to go with the latter, because I believe history proves it out. And my position on Bible history is that I am premillennial, and I am also a Protestant historicist. And you can, if you want a clue as to what Protestant historicism is, go to horeapocalypticae.wordpress.com and begin reading there. E.B. Eliot's Hore Apocalypticae in its the Reformation Quincentennial Edition. That's right. And you'll have a good clue. But go there after the broadcast. So we're looking at America today, and America seems more polarized than ever. But I'm going to tell you, it is not more polarized than ever. The polarization of the two-horned earth beast is more evident than ever, is what I believe. But you'll notice that the battle seems to be almost equal. You know, it's just like one side can't get up higher than the other side. But this is absolutely what is predicted by the scripture for America in Revelation chapter 13. America as the two-horned earth beast of Revelation chapter 13, as the image creator, the one that creates an image to the first beast, the sea beast. And that image is the United Nations. The United Nations is the New World Order. As opposed to the Old World Order, that was Rome when it ruled the world for 1260 years. The image of the beast is an image through which the beast that was and is not, yet is, can vicariously rule the world. And you can see that that image, the United Nations, in the New World, being the New World Order, is gaining more and more power all the time. And it will fulfill its place in history as it has in prophecy. If you read chapter 13, see, I'm going to put a link in here, and we can cover some of this really quick here. Paste. And this is horeapocalyptica.wordpress.com, and this is volume 3, chapter 9, Rise of the Two-Horned Earth Beast. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. Now this represents this like a lamb and dragon speaking are the descriptions of these two horn powers, okay? Because the horns represent power. We settled that, okay, by looking at what horns represent on other beasts that came before it. And he exercised all the power of the first beast before him and causes the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And he does great wonders so that he makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast. Chapter 13 of the Revelation is an overview of the life, machinations, and affiliations of the greatest and most enduring of the final world dominating powers or beasts created by mortal men from its very rise until it goes to perdition with its revived head and supporting companions. Those supporting companions? The earth beast and the image it creates. The attributes of the earth beast prefigured in the vision. Let's examine the mentioned attributes of this beast power from the divine text itself and see if we can find a candidate in subsequent history that satisfies all the criteria following. Here we refer to our previous chapter, and you can check that out. Discussion which identifies this new beast power with the seventh king beast of Revelation. And like I said, the Revelation outlines seven beast powers. It names the sixth one is contemporary with John being the Roman Empire. So there's one that comes after that. But what is it? What is the power that comes up after that? Okay. The first attribute. One, he is not yet come. Here's a direct future tense reference to an appearance of a seventh king beast power that did not previously exist. Future from the present tense of John receiving the revelation, and future from the one is then in existence, the sixth king beast already identified as Rome. Revelation 13 has the only mention of the appearance of an additional and subsequent beast power in the scripture, so it must be the same beast power mentioned in both texts. 2. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. Still directing us to a future tense, the author asserts the continuance of this beast power must be relatively short in comparison to the other beast powers before it, or at least the one immediately preceding and contemporary with it. We now turn back to our primary text above, Revelation 13, 11 through 14. This beast comes up out of the earth. First, we notice that this beast does not rise up out of the sea, as did the four previous beast powers. The sea, waters or flood, each respectively indicating multitudes or a densely populated area, such as the old world, and conquest by warfare or the sword. This earth beast would rise up without conquest of the beast preceding it, nor would it occupy the highly populated locality of the preceding beast powers. Next attribute, he had two horns like a lamb. For reference, averting our attention to the division of the Greek Empire, with its singular horn being broke off and supplanted by four horns, signifying for a new fourfold division. And the ten horns of the concurrent sea beast, three being plucked up before the little horn, etc. We expect to see something representing a twofold division of power during the continuance of this earth beast. Its being described as like a lamb may be an indicator as one of those horns, or a division of power, and the other indicated by our next attribute. He spake as a dragon. This dragon influence, or division, would be concurrent throughout the life of this beast power with the two horns, as we notice no change, or one horn being plucked up by another as the Grecian and Roman Empire beast previous to it. This beast may be somewhat schizophrenic, with a constant power struggle between its lamb-like qualities and its dragon-like conversation, especially in its support of the sea beast, which derives its power from the dragon or Satan, the god of this world. 6. He exercises all the power of the first beast before him. In its history, the Roman Empire ruled the then known world and all of its civilizations. It had military outposts in many of those nations. It was the police power of the world. This is the kind of power that will be necessary to fulfill the following tasks, number 7 through 14, set forth in the vision for this earth beast power. 7. Causes the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast. This is an overview of the end result and motivation of this horn division in the following actions, or in the biblical sense, its dragon conversation. He uses the following feats to accomplish world obedience to the first beast. 8. Doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. In the context, this power is military, an overwhelming military power. Remember the police power of the world. And contemporarily, this means firepower. 9. Deceiveth them that dwell in the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast. In the sight of the beast. Just think about that as we move on here. It's what the earth beast does in the sight of the sea beast, or this new world power does in the sight of the old world power, that brings obedience that they are deceived by. Here we continue the theme of overwhelming military power that would seem miraculous by any historical standard. 10. Saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast. So much so, this power, that the world will easily capitulate to the assembly of the image of the beast and eventual world obedience to it. 11. He had power to give life to the image of the beast. How do you give power to a political image? Firepower. That's right. Military power. Okay, he had power. The end result of the wonder, power, and miraculous machinations of this earth beast lead to the next step of worship or obedience to the image of the beast that was and is not and yet is, which is a description of the end time sea beast power. What would you say, what would you call that kind of description, I don't know how else to describe it, was and is not yet is. which will vicariously rule the world through the construct of the image. Like people say, the Roman Empire is dead. And people laugh when you tell them that the Antichrist is ruling the world. The Antichrist was outed, was identified 500, 600, 700 years ago. And the man of sin, the seat of the man of sin, has been fulfilled continuously all these centuries. And the throne is at the Vatican. And people laugh at you. They just scorn you. They make fun of you when you tell them that the shadow government works for him, that he is the Antichrist identified by the Reformed Fathers, not even accepted by the Reformed Church today. Yeah. Our next attribute, 12, and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed, indicating that the second beast's dragon actions must be the primary enforcement arm of the image it creates. Who is the primary military for the New World Order in the United Nations? The image created by America, this image of the sea beast, a world-dominating and ruling power. 13, and causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark. The object of this last attribute, that's a different topic, the mark of the beast. Section 2, identity of the earth beast prefigured in the vision. We now look to recent history, and it seems so obvious, so wonderfully fulfilled, that only one candidate among the prominent powers of the world stands out immediately as fulfilling every criteria of this two-horned earth beast in every detail prefigured in the apocalyptic vision. Here we expound upon them one point at a time. 1. America had not yet come at the reception of the revelation by John. The new world where this power appeared was an unknown. Upon the punishment and wounding, as it were to death, on that head of the sea beast, a dominion that lasted for 1,260 years under that head, and about 1,200 years before that, from its pagan beginnings, about the 8th century BC, the papal power and its Holy Roman Empire seemed to disappear. What was and is not, yet is. By 1870, it seemed only a powerless shadow of it remained. 2. America rises in the New World about the same time of the wounding of the Roman papal head, and has now existed little more than 200 years in its current constitutional form. How much time can this sea beast power, earth beast power continue before it exceeds the short space qualification? Exactly what is a short space in context of the prophecy? Even if Christ were not to appear for several hundred years more, America's time would be a short space by comparison to the sea beast or the Roman Empire. 3. America comes up out of the earth rather than the sea, representing peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues, where the four previous beast powers rose up. This beast rises out of the new world, sparsely populated by comparison. There's no conquest or necessity of assimilation, as noticed in the previous consecutive sea beast powers, so that this beast power can come alongside and support the sea beast as predicted in the text. 4. He had two horns like a lamb, and 5. He spake as a dragon. When a tenth part of the papal kingdom fell, which tenth E.B. Eliot identifies as the falling away of Protestant England, or the British Empire, or the British Isles, from the papal states, many had been fleeing to the New World to escape religious persecution and papal inquisition in the same place where Protestant England eventually established 13 colonies. Canada to the north was a crown colony of the sovereign city of London, under papal control. Mexico down through all of South America, Latin America, was conquered on behalf of the Vatican by the papal vassals of Portugal and Spanish conquistadors. In the New World, the only power that rose up and came to exhibit all of the attributes of the Revelation 13 Earth Beast is the one that developed out of the 13 colonies planted by Protestant England, the United States of America. And that I put that link in the chat room there. You can finish reading that article for yourself. And look at the connecting articles with it there. As a matter of fact, read the whole Hori Apocalyptica if you want a real education. Because you know what the Hori Apocalyptica is all about? It's all about history. And when you read history and you see how the Bible foretold that history, then you begin to understand what's going on, what in the world is going on. So, what say you? Is America Mystery Babylon? Or is it the two-horned earth beast of Revelation chapter 13? Well, I think it's proven by the Bible itself, which is which. Mystery Babylon. If you want a better understanding of Mystery Babylon, I have another article on my website that you need to read. And this is the most read article on my website. I'll put the link in the chat room right now. But it's called The Empire of the City, The Unholy Trinity That Rules the World. And there you'll find out about Mystery Babylon. And so spread those articles around. Take those links that I've given you, put them on your, social media, email them to a friend, show them to a neighbor, whatever. You know, email them to your whole list. And if with those two articles there, people have a good idea which one is which. Which is Mystery Babylon? Which one is the Earth Beast of Revelation chapter 13? And what is an earth beast? And how do we come to determination who the beast powers that are that are represented in the Revelation and apocalyptic prophecy of Daniel, and how they're related to each other? And they we use the Bible to interpret the Bible itself. It's real problematic for dispensationalists, amillennialists, who don't really consider these things. They don't really look for an interpretation. They have their hypotheses, and they have 10,000 conjectures to support their hypotheses. But they have not one explicit statement in the Bible to support it. And as far as rules, and I'm still writing my book, and I'm really not happy with it. I'm thinking about rewriting the whole thing, maybe even taking another year to do it. Because I was thinking about redoing it and starting all over, reorganizing everything, and calling it Rules for Interpretation, or Rules for Apocalyptic Interpretation, or something like that. And just go through it, you know. I've got it all written. I just have to reorganize everything because I'm not really happy with the organization of it. And if I do that, if I rewrite it, it'll be a full volume, you know, on prophecy. But I'm not going to do a Hori Apocalyptica. But it'll be a full overview of prophecy. And I've written a lot because the quincentennial edition of the Hori Apocalyptica, which I have linked there at horiapocalyptica.wordpress.com, is my, is at least as far as book volume 3 and 4, I made updates to bring it up to date. Because, you know, we're way beyond E.B. Eliot when he wrote the Hori Apocalyptica from about 1830 to the 1860s. He did 5 volumes over his life's work, and most of it excellent. But there were things that he did not see yet. He did not see the earth beast. and he violated some of the very rules that he was following, trying to figure out who the earth beast and the false prophet were. And he got it wrong. And a few other things he got wrong. And I have those noted in the updated versions. So I didn't have to change a lot, but there were some things that had to be updated. And so that's about the most, and to do a better job, you'd have to rewrite everything. But as I said, first, volumes 1 and 2 and most of 3 and 4 are excellent work as far as E.B. Eliot, and I hope that he would be happy with the updates. I believe if he had lived this long, he would have made many of the same updates that I did. Yes, it was a huge endeavor. It took me, it's been many years to complete that project. I think from beginning to end, about 7 years, actually. I'll never get paid for all that work. You know? Well, in a way of speaking, there's no monetary compensation that I'm going to receive for it. But hopefully, and you can even buy copies, but I put it out there for free. That's what I do with all my work, is I put it all out there for free. So it's published, for the most part, on horrorapocalyptica.wordpress.com. It's free. If you want printed copies, well, you can order them from the printer there, and they'll send you printed copies, and I get a little sales thing or whatever the author's share of any sales from that. And I even have an opportunity to discount. You'll notice everything there is discounted that I sell with the printers, because the discount comes out of what I would get as the author or publisher. So, but I think my work is that important that I should give it away free. Unlike so many others out there, nobody's giving, like I review a lot of books, like I'm reviewing this book right now. It's called A Case for Amillennialism, Understanding the End Times by Kim Riddlebarger. I love his name, Riddlebarger, because it's a barge of riddles, man. And that's where I come to my conclusion that amillennialism is like flat earth and dispensationalism. There's nothing explicit in the Bible on either any of those, but they're all built upon conjecture. And that's a sad state of affairs as far as I'm concerned. And with that sad state of affairs, I'm out of time. Anyway, stick around for those history lessons coming up, and may the Almighty bless you and keep you till we meet again.
When the fire deep within me is gone. News. I'm Rush DePue.
President Trump announced his Middle East peace plan. He proposes an independent Palestinian state and the recognition of Israeli sovereignty over West Bank settlements. Prime Minister of Israel Benjamin Netanyahu joined Fox and Friends to discuss.
I think the president has done something extraordinary. President Trump has brought forward a peace plan that enables us to make the deal of the century. It gives Israel security. It gives the Palestinians national dignity. It allows us to move forward so that we can live together. It's a deal that we should both make, and we're prepared to make it.
Republicans have wrapped up their opening arguments in President Trump's impeachment trial. Rachel Sutherland with more.
Counsel for both sides will be on the spot today as a 16-hour question and answer period begins. This is the fight over additional witnesses and documents intensifies. GOP Senator Mitt Romney says he'd like to hear from former National Security Advisor John Bolton.
Having each side be able to choose a witness or maybe more than one witness on a paired basis it has some merit.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told members he may not be able to stop the calling of additional witnesses. Democrats are rejecting the idea of senators reviewing a manuscript of Bolton's upcoming book in a classified setting. In Washington, Rachel Sutherland, Fox News.
A CNN panel disparaged millions of Trump supporters during a recent news broadcast. Steve Jordahl reports.
It had echoes of President Obama's description of Midwest voters clinging to their guns and religion, and Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables jab at Trump supporters. Last Saturday night on Don Lemon's CNN show, former GOP strategist Rick Wilson ripped into President Trump's base.
He knows that this is, you know, an administration defined by ignorance of the world. And so that's partly him playing to their base and playing to their audience, the credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump.
That's Lemon in the background cracking up. New York Times author Wajahat Ali joined in with a mocking Southern drawl.
Are you elitist with your geography and your maps and your spelling?
your math and your reading?
Yeah, your reading.
Meanwhile, Lemon is still doubled over in laughter. Kyle Drennan of Media Research Center says CNN cannot be both a comedy station and a legitimate news source.
This is not The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. This is not some late-night comedy skit. This is CNN primetime. It's supposedly a news show. This is supposed to be some kind of journalism.
But the last laugh, he says, may be on Lemon and the left.
Inevitably, I think it's going to have an impact on the election, because at some point, people are sick and tired of being, told that they're idiots, they're morons, they're just a bunch of rubes. It just reinforces their commitment to go out and vote and try to push back against that.
I'm Steve Jordahl.
The anti-Trump hatred from the left-wing media, like CNN, is only helping the president, as even a solidly blue state, New Jersey, turned out in enormous numbers to support him. More from Steve Rappaport.
President Trump touted his list of accomplishments at a Keep America Great rally in Wildwood.
America is winning again, and America is thriving again like never before.
And while the president says he's getting things done,
the congressional Democrats are obsessed with demented hoaxes, crazy witch hunts, and deranged partisan crusades.
But the president had nice things to say about a former Democrat.
We are truly honored to be here with the newest Republican member of the House of Representatives, your great Congressman Jeff Van Drew.
The New Jersey lawmaker joining the GOP after he voted against impeachment. Steve Rappaport, Fox News.
Stocks are off to another strong start on Wall Street as strong earnings reports from big U.S. companies got investors to set aside worries about a spreading virus in China. General Electric, Textron, and Norfolk Southern all rose today after turning in solid results. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury fell to 1.63%. American Family News is online at onenewsnow.com and download the One News Now mobile app. I'm Rusty Pugh.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Cross the Border. This is Christian History Edition. And in this segment, we're going to start a new series on John Huss and the Hussite Wars. Chapter 1, Birth, Education, and First Labors of Huss. In springtime, the husbandman begins to prepare for the harvest. He turns field after field with the plow, and when all is ready, he returns on his steps, scattering the precious seed on the open furrows. His next care is to see.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Good day, everyone, everywhere. You're listening to Cross the Border, another Christian history segment. In this, we're continuing our life and times of John Huss, and Chapter 3, Growing Opposition of Huss to Rome. The frightful picture which society now presented had a very powerful effect on John Huss. He studied the Bible, he read the early fathers, he compared these with the sad spectacles passing before his eyes. And he saw more clearly every day that the church had departed far from her early model, not in practice only, but in doctrine also. A little while ago, we saw him leveling his blows at abuses. Now we find him beginning to strike at the root on which all these abuses grew, if haply he might extirpate both root and branch together. It was at this time that he wrote his treatise on the church, a work which enables us to trace the progress of his emancipation from the shackles of earthly authority. He establishes in it the principle that the true Church of Christ does not necessarily have an exterior constitution. Rather, it has that communion with its invisible head, the Lord Jesus Christ, that alone necessary for it, and that the true Catholic Church is the assembly of all the elect. This tractate was followed by another under the title of The Six Errors. The first error was that of the priests who boasted of making the body of Jesus Christ in the Mass, and of being the creator of their creator. The second was the confession exacted of the members of the Church. I believe in the Pope and the saints, in opposition to which Huss taught that men are to believe in God only. The third error was the priestly pretension to remit the guilt and punishment of sin. The fourth was the implicit obedience exacted by ecclesiastical superiors to all their commands. The fifth was the making no distinction between a valid excommunication and the one that was not so. The sixth error was simony. This Huss designated as heresy, and scarcely, he believed, could a priest be found who was not guilty of it. This list of errors was placarded on the door of the Bethlehem Chapel. The tract in which they were set forth was circulated far and near, and produced an immense impression throughout the whole of Bohemia. Another matter, which now happened, helped to deepen the impression which his tract on the six errors had made. John 23 fulminated a bull against Ladislaus, king of Hungary, excommunicating him and all his children to the third generation. The offense which had drawn upon Ladislaus the burst of pontifical wrath was the support he had given to Gregory XII, one of the rivals of John. The Pope commanded all emperors, kings, princes, cardinals, and men of whatever degree, by the sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ, to take up arms against Ladislaus and utterly to exterminate him and his supporters. And he promised to all who should join the crusade, or who should preach it, or collect funds for its support, the pardon of all their sins, and immediate admission into paradise should they die in the war. In short, the same indulgences which were accorded to those who bore arms for the conquest of the Holy Land. This fulmination wrapped Bohemia in flames, and Hus seized the opportunity of directing the eyes of his countrymen to the contrast, so perfect and striking, between the Vicar of Christ and Christ himself, between the destroyer and the Savior, between the commands of the bull, which proclaimed war, and the precepts of the gospel, which preached peace. A few extracts from his refutation of the papal bull will enable us to measure the progress Hus was making in evangelical sentiments, and the light which through his means was breaking upon Bohemia. If the disciples of Jesus Christ, he said, were not allowed to defend him who is the chief of the church against those who wanted to seize on him, much more will it not be permissible to a bishop to engage in a war for a temporal dominion and earthly riches. As a secular body, he continues, to whom the temporal sword alone is suitable, cannot undertake to handle the spiritual one, in like manner, the ecclesiastics ought to be content with the spiritual sword and not make use of the temporal. This was flatly to contradict a solemn judgment of the papal chair, which asserted the church's right to both swords. A few extracts from his refutation of the papal bull will enable us to measure the progress Hus was making in evangelical sentiments, and the light which through his means was breaking upon Bohemia. Having condemned the Crusades, the carnage of which was doubly iniquitous when done by priestly hands, Hus next attacks indulgences. They are an affront to the grace of the gospel. God alone possesses the power to forgive sins in an absolute manner. The absolution of Jesus Christ, says he, ought to precede that of the priest. Or, in other words, the priest who absolves and condemns ought to be certain that the case in question is one which Jesus Christ himself has already absolved and condemned. This implies that the power of the keys is limited and conditional. In other words, that the priest does not pardon, but only declares the pardon of God to the penitent. If, he says again, the Pope uses his power according to God's commands, he cannot be resisted without resisting God himself. But if he abuses his power by enjoining what is contrary to divine law, then it is a duty to resist him, as should be done to the pale horse of the apocalypse, to the dragon, to the beast, and to the Leviathan. Waxing bolder as his views enlarged, he produced to stigmatize many of the ceremonies of the Roman Church as lacking foundation, as being foolish and superstitious. He denied the merit of abstinences. He ridiculed the credulity of believing legends and the groveling superstition of venerating relics, bowing before images, and worshipping the dead. They are profuse, said he, referring to the latter class of devotees, toward the saints in glory who want nothing. They array bones of the latter with silk and gold and silver and lodge them magnificently, but they refuse clothing and hospitality to the poor members of Jesus Christ who are amongst us, at whose expense they feed and drink till they are intoxicated. Friars, he no more loved than Wycliffe did, if we may judge from a treatise which he wrote at this time, entitled The Abomination of Monks, and which he followed by another, wherein he was scarcely more complimentary to the Pope and his court, styling them the members of Antichrist. Plainer and bolder every day became the speech of Huss. Fiercer grew his invectives and denunciations. The scandals which multiplied around him had, doubtless, roused his indignation, and the persecutions which he endured may have heated his temper. He saw John 23, than whom a more infamous man never wore the tiara, professing to open and shut the gates of paradise, and scattering so many pardons over Europe that he might kindle the flames of war and extinguish a rival in torrents of Christian blood. It was not easy to witness all this and be calm. In fact, the Pope's bull of crusade had divided Bohemia and brought matters in that country to extremity. The king and the priesthood were opposed to Ladislaus of Hungary and consequently supported John 23, defending as best they could his indulgences and simonies. On the other hand, many of the magnates of Bohemia and the great body of the people sided with Ladislaus, condemned the crusade which the Pope was preaching against him, together with all the infamous means by which he was furthering it, and held the clergy guilty of the blood which seemed about to flow in torrents. The people kept no measure in their talk about the priests. The latter trembled for their lives. The archbishop interfered, but not to throw oil on the waters. He placed Prague under interdict, and threatened to continue the sentence so long as John Huss should remain in the city. The archbishop persuaded himself that if Huss should retire, the movement would go down, and the war of factions subside into peace. But he deceived himself. It was not now in the power of any man, even of Huss, to control or stop that movement. Two ages were struggling together, the old and the new. The reformer, however, fearing that his presence in Prague might embarrass his friends, again withdrew to his native village of Hussnetz. During his exile he wrote several letters to his friends in Prague. Letters discover a mind full of that calm courage which springs from trust in God, and in them occur for the first time those prophetic words which Huss repeated afterwards at more than one important epoch in his career, the prediction taking each time a more exact and definite form. If the goose, his name in the Bohemian language signifies a goose, which is but a timid bird, and cannot fly very high, has been able to burst its bonds, there will come afterwards an eagle, which will soar high into the air and draw to it all other birds. So he wrote, adding, "It is in the nature of truth that the more we observe it, the brighter it will become." Huss had closed one career, and was bidden rest a while before opening a second and more sublime one. Sweet it was to leave the strife and clamor of Prague for the quiet of his birthplace, where he could calm his mind in the perusal of the inspired page and fortify his soul by communion with God. For himself he had no fears. He dwelt beneath the shadow of the Almighty. By the teaching of the word of the Spirit, he had been wonderfully emancipated from the darkness of error. His native country of Bohemia had, too, by his instrumentality, been rescued partially from the same darkness. Its reformation could not be completed, nor indeed carried much further, till the rest of Christendom had come to be more nearly on a level with it in point of spiritual enlightenment. So now the reformer is withdrawn. Never again was his voice to be heard in his favorite chapel of Bethlehem. Never more were his living words to stir the hearts of his countrymen. There remains but one act more for Huss to do, the greatest and most enduring of all. As the preacher of Bethlehem Chapel, he had largely contributed to emancipate Bohemia. As the martyr of Constance, he was largely to contribute to emancipate Christendom. You're listening to Across the Border. My name's Nicholas, and we are going through Christian history and the life and times of John Huss. In our next chapter, we will continue. Make sure you come back. May the Almighty bless you and keep you.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Visit crosstheborder.org, C-R-O-S-S, crosstheborder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of Nicholas Arthur's new book titled When the Third Temple is Built. That's crosstheborder.org. When it comes to prophecy today, much of the evangelical Christian world has their eyes on Israel, waiting and watching to see when the Third Temple will begin to be built. The plans are drawn, the Jewish people are eager. Most evangelical Christians today believe that the rapture will happen before the Third Temple is built. Hi, I'm Michael Eugene. I was taught that Daniel's 70th week was in the future. Is that really what the Bible teaches? Have we searched the Scriptures and found this to be true? Why is it so important for a re-established Israel to build a Third Temple in Jerusalem? Is it necessary to build a temple on the same location already occupied by the Dome of the Rock? Is it necessary for sacrifices to take place in the temple on Temple Mount? Is there really a rapture followed by 7 years of tribulation? What is the New Testament temple? Can we identify history and prophecy? Who is the first beast in Revelation chapter 13? Who are the seven kings in Revelation 17? I have asked all these questions, and I have found Nicholas Arthur's new book, When the Third Temple is Built, answers all these questions and more, using Scripture to interpret Scripture. The Bible says that no prophecy of Scripture is of any private interpretation. Nicholas shows us in his new book, When the Third Temple is Built, how the Bible interprets prophecy and not man's private interpretation. Visit crosstheborder.org, C-R-O-S-S, crosstheborder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of Nicholas Arthur's new book titled When the Third Temple is Built. That's crosstheborder.org.
Welcome back. You listened to Across the Border, another Christian history segment, and we're continuing in the life and times of John Huss. Chapter 4, Preparations for the Council of Constance. We have now before us a wider theater than Bohemia. It is the year 1413. Sigismund, a name destined to go down to posterity along with that of Huss, though not with like fame, had just recently mounted the throne of the empire. Wherever he cast his eyes, the new emperor saw only spectacles that distressed him. Christendom was afflicted with a grievous schism. There were three popes, whose personal profligacies and official crimes were the scandal of that Christianity of which each claimed to be the chief teacher, and the scourge of that church of which each claimed to be the supreme pastor. The most sacred things were put up to sale, and were the subject of simony bargaining. The bonds of charity were disrupted, and nation was going to war with nation. Everywhere strife raged, and blood was flowing. The Poles and Knights of the Teutonic Order were waging a war which raged only with the greater fury, inasmuch as religion was its pretext. Bohemia seemed on the point of being rent in pieces by intense commotions. Germany was convulsed. Italy had as many tyrants as princes. France was distracted by its factions, and Spain was embroiled by the machinations of Benedict XIII, whose pretensions that country had espoused. To complete the confusion, the Mussulman hordes, encouraged by these dissensions, were gathering on the frontier of Europe and threatening to break in and repress all disorders in a common subjugation of Christianity to the yoke of the prophet. To the evils of schism, of war, and Turkish invasion was now added the worse evil, as Sigismund doubtless accounted it, of heresy. A sincere devotee, he was moved even to tears by this spectacle of Christendom, disgraced and torn asunder by its several popes, and undermined and corrupted by its heretics. The emperor gave his mind anxiously to the question how these evils were to be cured. The expedient he hit upon was not an original one, certainly. It had come to be a stereotyped remedy, but it possessed a certain plausibility that fascinated men, and so Sigismund resolved to make trial of it. It was a general council. This plan had been tried at Pisa, and it had failed. This did not promise much for a second attempt. But the failure had been set down to the fact that then the mitre and the empire were at war with each other, whereas now the pope and the emperor were prepared to act in concert. In these more advantageous circumstances, Sigismund resolved to convene the whole church, all its patriarchs, cardinals, bishops, and princes, and to summon before this august body the three rival popes, and the leaders of the new opinions, not doubting that a general council would have authority enough, more especially when seconded by the imperial power, to compel the popes to adjust their rival claims, and put the heretics to silence. These were the two objects which the emperor had in mind, to heal the schism and to extirpate heresy. Sigismund now opened negotiations with John 23. To the pope, the idea of a council was beyond measure alarming, nor can one wonder at this. If his conscience was loaded with but half the crimes of which popish historians have accused him. But he dared not refuse the emperor. John's crusade against Ladislaus had not prospered. The king of Hungary was in Rome with his army, and the pope had been compelled to flee to Bologna. And terrible as a council was to Pope John, he resolved to face it, rather than offend the emperor, whose assistance he needed against the man whose ire he had wantonly provoked by his bull of crusade, and from whose victorious arms he was now fain to seek a deliverer. Pope John was accused of opening his way to the Tiara by the murder of his predecessor, Alexander V, and he lived in continual fear of being hurled from his chair by the same dreadful means by which he had mounted to it. It was finally agreed that a general council should be convoked for November 1st, 1414, and that it should meet in the city of Constance. The day came, and the council assembled from every kingdom and state, and almost from every city in Europe, came delegates to swell that great gathering. all that numbers and princely rank and high ecclesiastical dignity and fame and learning could do to make an assembly illustrious contributed to give eclat to the Council of Constance. 30 cardinals, 20 archbishops, 150 bishops, and as many prelates, a multitude of abbots and doctors, and 1,800 priests came together in obedience to the joint summons of the emperor and the pope. Among the members of sovereign rank were the electors of Palatine, of Mainz, and of Saxony, the dukes of Austria, of Bavaria, and Silesia. There were margraves, counts, and barons without number. But there were three men who took precedence of all others in that brilliant assemblage, though each on a different ground. These three men were the Emperor Sigismund, Pope John XXIII, and, last and greatest of all, John Huss. The two antipopes had been summoned to the council. They appeared not in person, but by delegates, some of whom were the cardinalate. This raised a weighty question in the council, whether these cardinal delegates should be received in their red hats. To permit the ambassadors to speak in the insignia of their rank might, it was argued, be construed into a tacit admission by the council of the claims of their masters, both of whom had been deposed by the Council of Pisa. But for the sake of peace, it was agreed to receive the deputies in the usual costume of the cardinalate. In that assembly were the illustrious scholar Poggio, the celebrated Thierry of Nîmes, secretary to several popes, and whom, it had been remarked, Providence placed near the source of so many iniquities for the purpose of unveiling and stigmatizing them. Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, greater as the elegant historian than as the wearer of the triple crown, Manuel Chrysolaris, the restorer of the world of some of the writings of Demosthenes and Cicero, the almost heretic John Charlier Garrison, the brilliant disputant Peter de Ali, Cardinal Cambrai, surnamed the Eagle of France, and a host of others. In the train of the council came a vast concourse of pilgrims from all parts of Christendom. Men from beyond the Alps and the Pyrenees mingled here, and with the natives of Hungarian and Bohemian plains. Room could not be found in Constance for this great multitude, and booths and wooden erections rose outside the city walls. So great an increase of the population of the little town, amounting, it is supposed, to 100,000 souls, rendered necessary a corresponding enlargement of its commissariat. All the highways leading to Constance were crowded with vehicles, conveyed thither all kinds of provisions and delicacies, the wines of France, the breadstuffs of Lombardy, the honey and butter of Switzerland, the venison of the Alps, and the fish of their lakes, the cheese of Holland, and the confections of Paris and London. The emperor and the pope, in the matter of the council, thought only of circumventing one another. Sigismund professed to regard John XXIII as the valid possessor of the tiara. Nevertheless, he had formed the secret purpose of compelling him to renounce it, and the pope, on his part, pretended to be quite cordial in the calling of the council, but his firm intention was to dissolve it as soon as it had assembled, if, after feeling its pulse, he should find it to be unfriendly to himself. He set out from Bologna on the 1st of October with a store of jewels and money. Some he would corrupt by presents, others he had hoped to dazzle by the splendor of his court. All agree in saying that he took his journey very much against the grain, and that his heart misgave him 1,000 times on the road. He took care, however, as he went onward, to leave the way open behind for his safe retreat. As he passed through the Tyrol, he made a secret treaty with Frederick, Duke of Austria, to the effect that one of his strong castles should be at his disposal if he found it necessary to leave Constance. He made friends likewise with John, Count of Nassau, and Elector of Mainz. When he had arrived with the League of Constance, he prudently conciliated the abbot of St. Ulrich by bestowing the mitre upon him. This was a special prerogative of the popes, of which the bishops thought they had cause to complain. Not a stage did John advance without taking precautions for his safety, all the more that several incidents befell him by the way, which his fears interrupted into auguries of evil. When he had passed through the town of Trent, his jester said to him, "The pope who passes through Trent is undone." In descending the mountains of Tyrol, at that point of the road where the city of Constance, with the lake and plain, comes into view, his carriage was overturned. The pontiff was thrown out and rolled on the highway. He was not hurt in the least, but the fall brought the color into his face. His attendants crowded round him, anxiously inquiring if he had come to harm. "By the devil," he said, "I am down. I had better have stayed in Bologna," and casting a suspicious glance at the city beneath, "I see how it is," he said. "That is the pit where the foxes are snared." John 23 entered Constance on horseback on the 28th of October, attended by 9 cardinals, several archbishops, bishops and other prelates, and numerous retinue of courtiers. He was received at the gates with all possible magnificence. "The body of the clergy," says L'Enfant, "went to meet him in solemn profession, bearing the relics of saints." All of the orders of the city assembled also to do him honor, and he was conducted to the episcopal palace by an incredible multitude of people. 4 of the chief magistrates rode by his side, supporting a canopy of cloth of gold. The sacrament was carried before him upon a white pad, with a little bell about its neck. After the sacrament, a great yellow and red hat was carried with an angel of gold at the button of the ribbon. All the cardinals followed in cloaks and red hats. Reichenthal, who had described the ceremony, said that there was a great dispute among the pope's officers as to who should have his horse. But Henry of Ulm put an end to it by saying that the horse belonged to him, as he was burgomaster of the town, and so he caused him to be put into his stables. The city made the present to the pope that are usual on these occasions. It gave him a silver gilt cup weighing 5 marks, 4 small casks of Italian wine, 4 great vessels of wine of Alsace, 8 great vessels of the country wine, and 40 measures of oats, all which presents were given with great ceremony. Henry of Ulm carried the cup on horseback, accompanied by 6 counselors, who were also on horseback. When the pope saw them before his palace, he sent an auditor to know what was coming. Being informed that it was presents from the city to the pope, the auditor introduced them and presented the cup to the pope in the name of the city. The pope, on his part, ordered a robe of black silk to be presented to the council. While the pope was approaching Constance on the side, John Huss was traveling toward it on the other. He did not conceal himself from the danger present in appearing before such a tribunal. His judges were parties in the cause. What hope could Huss entertain that they would try him dispassionately by the scripture to which he had appealed? Where would they be if they allowed such an authority to speak? But he must appear. Sigismund had written to King Wenceslaus to send him thither, and, conscious of his innocence and the justice of his cause, thither he went. In prospect of the dangers before him, he obtained, before setting out, a safe conduct from his own sovereign, also a certificate of his orthodoxy from Nicholas, Bishop of Nazareth, Inquisitor of the Faith in Bohemia, and a document drawn up by a notary and duly signed by witnesses, setting forth that he had offered to purge himself of heresy before a provincial synod at Prague, but had been refused audience. Afterwards, he caused writings to be affixed to the doors of all the churches and all the palaces of Prague, notifying his departure and inviting all persons to come to Constance who were prepared to testify either to his innocence or his guilt. To the door of the royal palace even did he affix such a notice, addressed to the king, to the queen, and the whole court. He made papers of this sort be put up at every place on his road to Constance. In the imperial city of Nuremberg, he gave public notice that he was going to council to give an account of his faith, and invited all who had anything to lay to his charge to meet him there. He started not from Prague, but from Karlowitz. Before setting out, he took farewell of his friends as of those he never again should see. He expected to find more enemies at the council than Jesus Christ had at Jerusalem, but he was resolved to endure the last degree of punishment rather than betray the gospel by any cowardice. The presentiments with which he began his journey attended him all the way. He felt it to be a pilgrimage to the stake. At every village and town on his route, he was met with fresh tokens of the power that attached to his name, and the interest his cause had awakened. The inhabitants turned out to welcome him. Several of the country cures were especially friendly. It was their battle which he was fighting, as well as his own, and heartily did they wish him success. At Nuremberg and other towns through which he passed, the magistrates formed a guard of honor and escorted him through the streets thronged with spectators eager to catch a glimpse of the man who had begun a movement which was stirring Christendom. He did not reach Constance until Christmas Eve. His arrival added a new attraction to the melodramatic performance proceeding at the little town. The Pope signalized the event by signing a pontifical mass. His arrival added a new attraction to the melodramatic performance proceeding at the little town. The Pope signalized the event by singing a pontifical mass. The Emperor assisting, attired in his character as deacon and reading the gospel. There came an edict from Caesar Augustus that all the world, etc. The ceremony was ended by John 23, presenting a sword to Sigismund, with an exhortation to the man into whose hand he put it to make vigorous use of it against the enemies of the church. The Pope, doubtless, had John Huss mainly in mind. Little did he dream that it was upon himself that its first stroke was destined to descend. The Emperor Sigismund, whose presence gave a new splendor to the feats and new dignity of the council, was 47 years of age. He was noble in person, tall in stature, graceful in manners, and insinuating in address. He had a long beard and flaxen hair, which fell in a profusion of curls upon his shoulders. His narrow understanding had been improved by study, and he was accomplished beyond his age. He spoke with facility several languages, and was a patron of men of letters. Having one day conferred nobility upon a scholar, who was desirous of being ranked among nobles rather than doctors, Sigismund laughed at him, and said that he could make 1,000 gentlemen in a day, but he could not make 1 scholar in 1,000 years. The reverse of his more mature years had sobered the impetuous and fiery spirit of his youth. He committed the error common to almost all princes of his age, in believing that in order to reign it was necessary to dissemble, and that craft was an indispensable part of policy. He was a sincere devotee, but just in proportions as he believed in the church. He was scandalized and grieved by the vices of the clergy. It cost him infinite pains to get this council convoked, but all had been willingly undertaken in the hope that the assembled Christendom would be able to heal the schism and put an end to the scandals growing out of it. The name Sigismund had come down to posterity with an eternal blot upon it. How such darkness came to encompass a name which, but for one fatal act, might have been fair, if not illustrious, we shall presently see. Meanwhile, let us rapidly sketch the opening proceedings of the council, which were but preparatory to the great tragedy in which it was destined to culminate. You're listening Across the Border. My name's Nicholas, and we are going through Christian history and the life and times of John Huss. In our next chapter, we will continue in the deposition of the rival popes. Make sure you come back. Until we meet again, may the Almighty bless you and keep you.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
American Family News, I'm Rusty Pugh. The United States isn't the only country evacuating citizens from the Chinese city at the center of the coronavirus outbreak. Simon Owen reports.
Britain saying it's preparing to fly citizens back from Wuhan, China, the city where the mysterious new virus first appeared last month. The health secretary in London saying those returning to the UK will be put in quarantine for 2 weeks. It's reported that could be at a military base. Australia is going one further.
There is a rather limited window here, and we are moving very, very swiftly.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison saying evacuated nationals will be sent to Christmas Island, some 1,200 miles from the mainland. Japan and the EU are also organizing flights. Simon Owen, Fox News.
The Senate impeachment trial continues today. President Trump's legal team is making their case in defense of the president as they battle with House prosecutors over the issue of witnesses. U.S. Representative Doug Collins of Georgia joined Fox and Friends to discuss the trial so far.
You know, the one interesting thing here is that for the first time, what we're actually probably going to see here, and I think we'll actually see this, the only bipartisan part of this whole impeachment sham will be bipartisan to acquit the president.
With less than a week to go before the Iowa caucus, some Democratic candidates are canvassing the state while others are in Washington, D.C. Tanya J. Powers has more.
Four of the Democratic presidential candidates are spending the majority of their time in the Senate this week instead of making nonstop speeches and holding rallies in Iowa. The Iowa caucus is on Monday, and in the run-up, Senator Sanders, Warren, Klobuchar, and Bennett are serving as jurors in the Trump impeachment hearings. According to the Des Moines Register, other candidates, including former Vice President Joe Biden, former Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Andrew Yang, and Tom Steyer, have full appearance schedules in Iowa to take advantage of time. Town halls, community events, and block parties are just some of the things on the schedule. Senator Elizabeth Warren is expected back in Iowa on Thursday. Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
A death row inmate in Georgia could be hours away from execution.
Bonnie Cleveland Lance facing a lethal injection tonight for the 1997 murders of his ex-wife and her new boyfriend. It was a violent crime. The boyfriend hit with at least two shotgun blasts. The ex bludgeoned to death. Lance convicted despite there being no witnesses and no physical evidence to link him to the killings, which he has always denied. The Georgia Supreme Court has declined to hear an appeal. The State Board of Pardons and Paroles has denied Lance's request for clemency. His lawyers have asked the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the execution. Jack Callahan, Fox News.
An immigration reform organization is calling this week's Supreme Court ruling allowing enforcement of a new green card rule a win for the American taxpayer. Chad Groening has more.
By a 5-4 decision, the High Court reversed a ruling from the 2nd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New York that prevented the Trump administration from implementing its public charge policy, which allows immigration officials the ability to deny green cards to legal immigrants over their use of public benefits. The justices did not rule on the merits of several lawsuits challenging the rules, but only allowed the policy to remain in place. The lawsuits will continue, but immigrants applying for permanent residency must now show they wouldn't be public charges or burdens to the country. Ira Melman of the Federation for American Immigration Reform.
Obviously, everything gets litigated these days. The Supreme Court stepped in and said, while this is going on, there's every reason why the administration should be allowed to pursue this policy while the case itself is being decided in the courts. And that is a big win for the American taxpayer.
In a separate opinion, Justice Neil Gorsuch urged his colleagues to confront the real problem of so-called nationwide injunctions, orders issued by a single judge that apply everywhere.
We are in a situation now where every federal judge seems to have veto power over any particular federal policy, and that's not particularly the way the system was designed to run. The judiciary is there to decide on constitutional issues, at least the federal judiciary, and that's what they should be doing. So Judge Gorsuch is absolutely correct. We cannot give every guy with a black robe veto power over any particular policy that he or she doesn't like.
I'm Chad Groening.
American Family News is available online at onenewsnow.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and download the One News Now mobile app for your Apple or Android device. I'm Rusty Pete.
The book of Revelation says, "The spirit of prophecy is the testimony of Jesus Christ." This is at the very heart of FirstAmendmentRadio.com. In that spirit, we have created the Prophecy Reality News app for all of your mobile devices, streaming First Amendment Radio 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Available for your Apple, Android device, and smartphone absolutely free. Get the Prophecy Reality News app installed today, so you can listen to First Amendment Radio wherever you are. The Prophecy Reality News app. Get it now.
Okay, praise the Lord, you guys, and welcome. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Today on the show, we are going to talk about how perilous times have come. Perilous times have come. This, of course, is a direct reference to the New Testament, a warning in 2 Timothy chapter 3 from the Apostle Paul. And we're going to go over these scriptures and then talk about what is happening in the world today. Right now, Americans and probably people all over the world are watching with this incredible impeachment process that the Democratic Party has been pushing and promoting and now has gone from the House into the Senate. I watched parts of it earlier today. It was incredible. I'm sitting there watching what I could only call a fiasco of argumentation, where they're arguing that because President Trump, the President of the United States, called for an investigation into what Joe Biden and his son were doing in the Ukraine, when there's videotape of Joe Biden openly making the firing of a certain prosecutor conditional for whether or not they're going to get certain money from the United States. And the Democrats are saying to do something like that is supposedly illegal. And yet that's exactly what Joe Biden did, this quid pro quo thing. That's supposedly illegal, and now they're accusing Trump of doing this and Russia collusion and everything else. I mean, it's just unbelievable what's happening. But what's really going on? I think most people recognize, most people at least who care about the country and who care about truth and what's right and so on, recognize that the Democratic Party and really the radical left, the left wing, these socialists, these communists, these Sharia Muslims, they are, and the globalists collectively, they are desperate to get control of our country. to turn our country, really to use our country as a vehicle for their depraved ambitions. That's what they want. And this whole issue with the impeachment, I think this is just one part of a much darker reality that's happening in our country. And there's many things going on throughout the civilized world right now. But what is it? What's at the heart of it? At the heart of it is, I believe, rebellion against God collectively. So let's look at 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1, beginning at verse 1, where Paul says to Timothy, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come, for men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy." Now let's just look at that first part. Men shall be lovers of their own selves. There's no question that the I, my, me generation is what emerged after World War II. The whole idea of, you know, the self-help books, all of this focus on self, self-love. You have the song, "The Greatest Love of All," learning to love yourself, rather than the greatest love being learning to love God. To, you know, the two great commands, Jesus said, are to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus said, "Greater love hath no man than this, that he should lay down his life for his friends." To lay down your life for others is the greatest love. And of course, that would be in obedience to God. So in doing that, you would be loving God and your fellow man. But now we're being told, well, at least through the song, the famous song, "The Greatest Love of All," is learning to love yourself. This focus on self is very interesting, that that is at the heart of the corruption that Paul is warning about. This self-love. Lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. We see all of these elements at work in our world and society today. Without natural affection. Now that's very interesting. Natural affection, the typical natural relationships. This could very well be a reference to what's going on with this whole LGBT movement, where they are trying to destroy the traditional family. And you've had ministers that have warned about this for many years, that really the whole concept of gay marriage, and the gays have admitted this, the concept of gay marriage is not really about gays getting married. It's about trying to destroy the institution of marriage entirely and trying to destroy the construct of a family.